three rounds in and we might well be done here. Welcome to Bike Live here on Motorsport 101. Let's go! Yes, on that cheer note, welcome to episode 6 of Bike Life here on Motorsport 101 as we look back on the Aragon round of the World Superbike Championship, which may actually prove to be a very critical weekend in the destiny of this season's World Superbike Championship, as Jonathan Rea extended his lead despite losing his winning streak in 2017 over Chas Davies. We'll look at all the big stories from Aragon as Chas Davies crashed out of the first race from a winning position before beating Rea in the second. Marco Melandri taking a double podium and Alex Lowes becoming Alex Lowes again in race two. More on that later on. We'll also talk about World Supersport, which is now 3-for-3 for batshit crazy races this season, and the debut of the World Supersport 300. We'll give our first impressions on that new class. We'll also talk about the opening round of the British Superbike Championship as BSB took a sensible pill and pulled a concussed shaky burn out of the weekend, and Leon Haslam took full advantage with a double race victory. We'll also look ahead to this weekend as MotoGP returns at Termas 3 Hondo in Argentina for round two of the championship. It's a warm welcome once again. I'm Lewis Sutterby, to all of you listening in, and to Andre Harrison, who joins me this week. Welcome along, Andre.
Yeah, bear with me, you guys. I am suffering a little bit of a cold, but I'm going to soldier on like Alex Lowes. Well, hopefully without the crashing part, but in any case, yes, I'm here. Welcome back, everybody. Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Hopefully I won't lose you halfway through there. A bad case of Dre flu at the moment. So yeah, hopefully he'll soldier on. We'll keep going. We're actually both soldiering on here because we're recording this on the Thursday, the April 6th at 10:30 in the morning. So yeah, one of us has a cold, one of us is really low on sleep. So this might be a fun show to record. Let's tell you first of all while we wake up about the places you can find us on social media. First of all, our website, which is motorsport101.net, dedicated sections to both Motorsport 101 and Bike Live over there now, so check that out. On Facebook, we are facebook.com/motorsport101. Our Twitter, go ahead, Dre.
It's @motorsport_101. I have actually practiced to get this right. I completely butchered it on this week's episode.
Yes, @motorsport_101. On YouTube, where you can see Dre's weekly Google Hangouts, youtube.com/motorsport101. And if you like us so much, you can back us on Patreon. patreon.com/motorsport101, where if you do support us on there, that will earn you early access to each of our weekly shows, Motorsport 101 and Bike Live, which we're getting into a bit of a pattern now of releasing Motorsport 101 on a Wednesday and Bike Live on a Friday. We'll do our best to keep that up.
That's all Lewis, by the way. I do not claim to be the organizer. That's all him.
Yeah, so staying up till 4 a.m. on a Monday night to watch Monday Night Raw comes in awfully handy when you've got a podcast to edit. Yes. Thank the WWE for that. Let's crack on then with this week's Bike Live, episode 6. And we're still very, very early in the season. We're on April 6th, Dre, but we might have had a very championship-defining weekend out in Aragon for the third round of the World Superbike Championship because of what happened in race one. We'll start with Super Pole, where Chas Davies did what Chas Davies very rarely does, and that's take pole position for a World Superbike round. He just pipped the two Factory Kawasaki's to it with Sykes and Rea second and third on the grid, or second and third and the other way around. Rea outqualified Sykes again out in Aragon. And we got the head-to-head that we kind of hoped we'd see. We kind of feared we might see a Chas Davies escape act in those two races. We didn't get it. Jonathan Rea stayed with him. And Chas Davies crashing out. Now, that's the second time he's done that this year. He did that in the first part of the second Thailand race before the red flag came out. And those are the kind of moments that when you're playing catch-up, Chas Davies can seldom afford a crash, especially when he's cracking out of a lead with Jonathan Rea right on his tail. But unfortunately, that's what we got.
It is, unfortunately, what we've got. And sadly, I think it's kind of become a bit of a pattern of Chas Davies' career, either littered with bad luck or one critical mistake that may have cost him very dearly. And like this is Davies land. He loves Aragon. He's won there 5 times before. And he had, I'd say, a good half second going into that final lap if he makes it through the last corner okay. I think Davies takes a double here if he doesn't crash at the penultimate corner there on the penultimate lap there. It was a it was an awful, awful mistake, and it just seems to be one that may have gifted Ray 25 extra points he didn't deserve, frankly.
He kind of gifted 30, didn't it? Because Chaz lost, Chaz lost the 25 and Ray gained 5.
Exactly. So when you weigh it up like that, it was a dreadful mistake, and one that really, if anything, David should have completely avoided. He wasn't under immediate pressure, and it just seemed like a very, very weird sort of unforced error from Chaz. It's just bizarre, really, that Chaz, who was riding so well to get to that point, and it looked like he finally got on the measure of Jonathan on that one. Boff, down he goes, and you can see the frustration. Him kicking himself, figuratively and literally, after he crashed. And he knew how much this meant, and he knew what a disastrous result that was.
Yeah, because if you look at the championship standings as they are now, and we'll come on to them, and we'll round them up in full later on, but it's a 50-point lead for Jonathan Rea after what happened in race two, which we'll talk about shortly. So with that 30-point swing, if Chaz Davis does double up at Aragon, even with Jonathan Rea second, the lead back down to 20 points again, and we've got a real championship on. Even if Jonathan Rea is looking now unbeatable at most circuits on the calendar, a 20-point gap is small. But there's two ways of looking at it, because as you say, there's one way of looking at it is that it was an unforced error from Chaz Davis, that he had a bit of a cushion over Jonathan Rea and decked it. But I look at that and I kind of think that, is that an unforced error, or is that simply that Chaz Davis has to take it to the absolute edge of the envelope just to stay ahead of Jonathan Rea right now?
It seemed like that. I mean, we mentioned it last year. Chaz Davis won this race as a canter in 2016. He won both races very comfortably indeed. No fret at all. This year, Jonathan Rea was in control for most of the weekend. And they mentioned it on commentary about Jonathan seemed to be easier on his tyre, and Davis was sliding all over the place towards the end of that race. And yeah, I think he made a very good point. Maybe Davis was at 110% trying to keep himself ahead at that point, because Jonathan was looking very comfortable out there all weekend long. Again, it seems that Kawasaki has made real progress to making that team Jonathan Rea's this year, because he's so comfortable out there, so flexible. He's gotten to a point where he's now good anywhere. And if anyone wants to beat him, they've got to go beyond a reasonable limit to be able to give Jonathan a race. And that's what Chaz had to do on both occasions to get that one win and to have that accident. That's the fine line we're talking about in World Superbikes now.
Yeah, one thing we can never question, though, about Chaz Davis is his mental strength and his ability to bounce back from these kind of mistakes and these kind of problems that he has in a race weekend. Because race two comes around, of course, by virtue of the new for 2017 grid rules, Chaz Davis didn't get two poles for the weekend, despite taking super pole on the Saturday. He was back to 10th on the grid for race two, as the first of the fastest qualifier that didn't finish in the top nine, which put him 10th on the grid. Yet both to a lesser extent actually, Jonathan Rea and Tom Sykes both made rapid progress in those first couple laps. I mean, Rea was sensational again. To slide his way through, he was second within a lap and a half, wasn't he?
It was incredible. By lap three, he was in second place.
And,
the level of controlled aggression from Jonathan Rea on these race two starts is insane to watch. He's magnificent in that.
Because Aragon is one of those circuits where you shouldn't be able to do that, especially because of the short run to the first corner, that tight turn one, which just sort of, it's a bottleneck, and it's horrible for the guys that are sort of mid-pack, because there's just so many bikes trying to funnel into a one line corner, essentially.
Pretty much.
Turn one. So for Jonathan Rea to do that. But Chaz Davis didn't really, did he? He didn't really make that early progress. He was still behind Sykes and Melandri, and obviously the two Yamahas earlier, and yet he still came through. And credit where it's due, Chaz Davis, a mega response. And actually, when we look at the way he rode, it kind of backs up our point about Chaz, about how hard he's having to try just to stay with Jonathan Rea right now, because he very nearly decked it in the final lap of race two as well.
Very, very much so. I mean, he had that great big wobble on the final lap. Again, Davis looked like he had it comfortably, and then he had a massive wobble in the second sector of the final lap, and that allowed Jonathan to bunch right up again, and that probably is what gave Rea the opus to go for that penultimate quarter dive bomb attempt at the chicane. Yeah, it was the Hail Mary attempt, and he very nearly got it. He left Chaz literally a cigarette paper's width of room to get through back on the inside again. But Whew. Don't call Jonathan Rea someone that isn't a racer, because he had no reason to go for that whatsoever, but he did.
It was great though, wasn't it? The way sort of Chaz just cut back through on the extra corner and almost gave him a little tap on the way past as he went past, and Jonathan Rea must have sort of seen that happen and thought, yeah, this guy wants this one a bit more than me, and he needs this one. I mean, Jonathan Rea wins that and he goes 6 from 6. I mean, that would have been scary. Especially given that we have Assen next, which is one of Jonathan Rea's favourite circuits. But even in the Honda days, he used to win there all the time. So Jonathan Rea giving up 5 points, but I think Chaz Davies needed that one badly in race two. And as I say, he seems to be very good at this. I mean, last season you can argue that he didn't really hit form until the game was up, until the title was lost and the pressure was off. But, you know, to have that crushing disappointment in race one, to lose the race with a lap and a bit to go, you know, not many riders would have come back from that and won race two from 10th on the grid, but Chaz did it.
A very gritty performance from Chaz in race two, I completely agree, and one where he had to really earn it. Like, Chaz, it's come in clear that Chaz is not as talented an overtaker as Jonathan Rea is. No. Chaz had to pace himself a little bit more in that race. Jonathan Rea was leading the race comfortably by the end of lap 5, but Chaz had to get through Vandermark, both Yamahas essentially, his own teammate and Tom Sykes. And he took his time to get up there, but he managed his pace extremely well. And then he came on strong towards the end of that race and had the pace to do it. And again, forced Jonathan into having to basically go 100% to try and win the race. And again, he made it a bit more difficult for himself with that last lap mistake, but he got the job done in the end. And again, it was a very gritty performance, one where not only he needed the win, I think the entire series needed somebody else to win at this point. Otherwise, like, all morale would have been sucked out of the entire paddock at this point. If Jonathan goes 6 for 6, including Aragon with a 55-point lead, that would have been just end of day sort of discussions right here. So the fact that Chaz came back and won race two in very majestic fashion indeed was very impressive.
He needed that one badly, and it gives him a bit of confidence to take to Assen, where although Jonathan Rea did double up last year, Chaz was very close to him in both races.
Absolutely.
Last year, or you'd say he would have been close in that second race had he not made that mistake in the wet to dry race where he changed tyres too late. So we look forward to that, to see if Chaz can close the gap there. But for Jonathan Rea though, Dre, even though he's lost his winning streak, it was kind of fitting on WrestleMania weekend that a big winning streak came to an end. But it just more superlatives for him though, surely. Even though, because this is not a circuit that he expected to be winning at, he expected to be kind of following Chaz home around Aragon, and we can't speak highly enough for this guy at the moment, can we? Because if we look at his teammate, Tom Sykes, who is a world champion and a quality rider, was barely in the same postcode as Jonathan Rea. And when you look at the balance of power between Kawasaki and Ducati, it was definitely favoured on the side of Ducati this weekend, because Melandri beat Sykes by a little distance in both races. So that's the sort of number two riders, if you like, and where they're both at. Melandri beat Sykes twice, yet Jonathan Rea was on... Surely this is Jonathan Rea making the difference here rather than the Kawasaki making the difference, because Rea had no right really to be anywhere near Chaz Davies this weekend, did he?
No, not in the slightest. This is Chaz Davies land. I've mentioned this before. And in race two, Jonathan Rea was 10 seconds ahead of Tom Sykes. 10 seconds in a 20-lap race where, again, so Jonathan Rea is basically giving you half a second more on that bike right now. That's a terrifying advantage. And like you say,
like Sykes got stuck in traffic either. He made the same progress Jonathan Rea did.
Exactly. Like, Sykes was following Jonathan through most of these times around. And just in open air, Jonathan Rea is so much faster in terms of race pace right now. Sykes might still have a close, minuscule advantage over a single lap, but Jonathan's improved in every facet of his game this year. And he's now winning races on paper he shouldn't really be winning. And that is the ultimate sign of someone being on another level, is when you're winning races on the form book that you're not really meant to. And again, Melandri and Ducati were very fast this weekend. I mean, Melandri had hit 202 miles an hour on the speed traps in race two there, which I had to tweet Greg Haynes about. I said, well, that was a speed record. He never got back to me on that one, unfortunately. Greg, if you're listening, dig out the stat book. But in the meantime, Melandri, again, Ducati, this is a Ducati track. They're very powerful. They're very fast around here. This track favours them. And despite that, Jonathan Rea was in contention for both race wins and could have very easily won both wins. And if that happens, kiss this title goodbye, quite frankly. But in any case, Jonathan is, again, like you say, there's no superlatives left for how fast this man is on a superbike right now. He is practically invincible, and that's a very, very hard thing to say about a rider in any form of two-wheel motorsport when they're that dominant. But yeah, Jonathan is making the rest of the field look sheepish. Him and Chaz Davis are in another league compared to the field, and Jonathan might be one league ahead of Chaz, which is just terrifying.
Yeah, he is, because you see, very easy, obviously, we've judged what happened in race one with Chaz making the crash, but that's why I bring up the fact that Jonathan was probably putting so much pressure on him that Chaz had to ride like that just to stay ahead, because the guy's too good at the moment. There's just no obvious weakness in his game. Because even in previous years with Jonathan Rea, you could at least say, well, at least he's not as quick as Sykes in Super Poles. At least he's qualifying on the sort of second row sometimes, but he's not even doing that anymore.
No.
I don't know how much of that is the new Super Pole tyre. I don't know how much of that is just Jonathan Rea just feeling at one now with the bike, where he feels he can push it on one lap as well and get the best out of it. Because he's now 3-for-3 in Super Poles over Sykes, even though it was very close on Saturday. They were pretty much on identical times at Aragon. And he's now 5 wins in a second out of 6 races. And the second was a very close second. World Superbikes is a very, very long season. It's not like World Super Sport, absolutely, where there is once per weekend. So we still have, overall, 20 races to go, which is a hell of a lot. So it's still not in the realms of championship over, because there's 20 races to go yet. A lot can change and a lot can happen. But at the moment, Dre, it's hard to see anybody getting close to Jonathan Rea long term.
Because we know how good he is. Like, if you had walked into this season saying, oh, we're going to give Jonathan Rea a 50-point lead through 3 rounds, would you think anybody would beat him over the rest of the season? No, because he's so consistent. Yeah. That's Jonathan Ray's magnum opus. It's the fact that if the bike has no problems, he will finish the race on the podium. It's happened over 90% of the time since he's joined Kawasaki. He doesn't give his opponents wiggle room. If you want to beat him, you've got to be like Chaz, where you can win 6 or 7 on the bounce, really, and hope that Jonathan finishes lower than second so you can take more substantial points out of him. But he's so good at damage limitation, he's so good at not making mistakes, and he's so good at winning the races he can win, that he doesn't give any major opposition threat any sort of breathing room or any sort of momentum where he can rack up results. That's how good he is. And when you're so good, you can basically nullify anything that any other opponent throws at you. Good luck, because, again, Jonathan's won 5 out of 6, and he's made it look very, very easy throughout those 6 races so far. And who cares if he's given 5 points to Chaz on this one? He's got 50 in hand. So unless you see Chaz within the next 6 or 7, which I don't, because, again, he's Jonathan Rea's super strong at Assen. Portimao is another track he's very strong at as well. When you've got another good set of Kawasaki rounds coming soon, not to mention Donington, where Tom Sykes will most likely take both, because Sykes loves Donington like an adopted child. It's one of those things where I don't see where Chaz gets these 50 points back from unless Jonathan makes mistakes, which he doesn't.
Right. I mean, it's very interesting, because Greg, one of the things Greg Kane said at the weekend with Jonathan Rea, that Johnny Rea really wanted a double, or he really wanted at least a win at Aragon, given that it's usually Chaz Davies' territory. And he also said that Jonathan Rea really does want to win at Donington Park this year. He really does want to sort of snap that winning streak of Sykes, because that's almost the only thing that Rea has left now. He's got his championships, he's got so many wins and podiums, so he almost wants to sort of tick the boxes now, the places he hasn't won yet. Donington is one of those, and obviously Sykes will be going for a perfect 10 there this year, which is a fitting reference in this week of all weeks. So Sykes has got that on. That's probably the only thing he has on Jonathan Rea right about now. So Rea will be looking to try and take that one back in May. And as I say, thinking of the championship, it's 50 points now, and obviously Chaz will be looking to reel that in. But who's to say that gap's not just going to grow and grow? I don't think it's going to stop at 50. At the moment, I mean, and Chaz is already in the sort of realms where he needs some DNFs or some mistakes from Rea, because Ray's showing no sign of letting up and getting any slower or getting any threat from within his team. And we'll talk about Sykes ever so briefly, Dre. And again, he was a long way behind Jonathan Rea again, but again, I find it hard to be too critical, because how much of this is Sykes struggling and how much of this is Rea just being on another planet?
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where it's like, well, how, like, what's the true baseline of this bike? I used to use this argument when I was talking about Felipe Massa in his days at Ferrari and
measuring Sykes against one of the greats of World Superbikes history.
Exactly. In the same way that you were mentioned, you were referencing Felipe Massa, like you're going up against a guy that's won 30 plus Grand Prix and two world titles. So you're looking at, like, what's the true baseline of the car here? In the same way that in this case, what's the true baseline of the bike? And if this team is still focused on Tom Sykes, they're kidding themselves at this point. That's just the reality of it now. Like, Sykes is not Jonathan Rea. That's just the sad reality of it. I've tried pulling for this dude, but at this point, like, Kawasaki is basically cutting off its own nose to smite its face if it still thinks it's Tom Sykes' team. If Jonathan Rea is your franchise guy, he is on the way to rewriting the entire rulebook of World Superbikes at this point. And again, it's not that Sykes is bad. He's still an excellent one-lap guy. He is still going to leave a weekend with at least 30 points in hand.
He's a world champion.
He's a world champion, and he will still get podiums every weekend. He's that sort of guy, and I'm sure he'll win a couple rounds between now and the end of the season. Again, Donington is coming up. He's almost bound to win both there at least, and he'll probably sneak two or three more in other places because he's Tom Sykes. He's still an excellent elite level world superbike rider, but unfortunately, we are witnessing an all-time great run by Jonathan Rea here, where if he wins three in a row, which he's looking very likely to do that right now, 1-6 of the bookies, by the way, on that one, Jonathan Rea now to win his third straight title. So we are witnessing something historic here right now.
And something that's never been done in World Superbikes. Yeah. No one has ever won three in a row in the World Superbike Championship in its history, and we're in our 30th year now of the World Superbike Championship. And even the greats, even the likes of Fogarty and Bayliss, never won three titles in a row. So that's what Jonathan Rea, that's what we're talking about here with Jonathan Rea. That's the ground he's walking into, ground that hasn't been trodden in before in this championship, which just tells you how good he is right now. He is as good as anybody out in the world at the moment on a superbike, and you know, there are very few motorcycle riders, period, that are on as good a form as Jonathan Rea right now.
Real talk, if there was a pound-for-pound list of bike riders in the world, Jonathan Rea would be number one for me right now.
Yeah, it's like we're doing our power rankings. He'd be up there. He's in phenomenal form at the moment. And leads the championship, as I say, by 50 points from Chaz Davies. Sykes is still third, by the way. He's 54 off the lead, so just four behind Chaz. So it's kind of following that pattern of the last 2 years, isn't it? With Davies and Sykes will end up having that sort of late-season battle for second in the points behind Jonathan Rea. That seems to be where we're heading at the moment. As Davies sort of takes more wins and then gives the points back to Sykes by crashing every now and again. So we'll follow that as the season goes on. The battle for second, Davies will of course hope that it becomes a battle up for the title, but he needs to sort of string some more wins together for that to happen. But at least he's on the board with his first win of the season. His teammate's still chasing his first win of the year, and his first win since returning to World Superbikes, Dre. But I think we're almost, even three rounds in, we can almost already call this Marco Melandri return a success, can't we?
I think so. I think this is exactly what Ducati would have wanted from Marco Melandri. And I think they know that Chaz Davies is the leader of that team and is the guy that is going out there and you know, killing it right now. And again, that's absolutely, you know, more than understandable given how good he's been the last two or three seasons. But Marco is doing an excellent job in that support role. He is picking up where the results where he can get them. He is challenging the front two on occasions. I think maybe he's got issues with managing his tyres, which is why he's lost out a little bit in the long run. But he's not making the mistakes that Davide Giuliano did. Not really. He had the one little slip-up in Finnair Parma. Besides that, he's been very good. His main threat is Tom Sykes. And Sykes is on a very fast Kawasaki, probably the best overall bike in the field, and a former world champion. And Melandri is giving him his money's worth right now. So, again, I don't think you could ask for much more, realistically, out of Marco Melandri right now. He's doing an excellent job, and he is playing that support role. He's not interrupting in Davis's point scoring as much as I thought he might, which is actually probably a good thing for the team overall in the long run. But yeah, Malandry hasn't really put a foot wrong, and he's doing what he needs to do. He's doing a professional job out there, which is, again, something that could be a bit debatable with Malandry over the years, but he's doing an effective job. So props to him. He's doing what he needs to do.
Yeah, he is. And last season, just looking through last season, Davide Giuliano, over the course of the entire 2016 season, had 5 podiums. Marco Landry's had 4 already in 6 races.
Wow.
In 2017, and one of those other two was a 4th, and he might well have been on the podium in Phillip Island Race 1 had he not tangled with Alex Lowe's. So Malandry is doing exactly what Ducati would have hoped he would do. Is, as you say, he's be quick, be right there, but not quite quick enough to mess Chas Davies up, which is what Ducati really want from their, I don't want to call them second rider, because Malandry would hate being called that, but that's kind of where he's at the moment in that team. And for the Manufacturers Championship, that's exactly what Malandry needs to do, because, of course, the way the manufacturers works, if for those that aren't familiar with World Superbikes and motorcycle racing in general, only the first bike home for each manufacturer scores manufacturers' points. So whereas last season, if Chas had a crash, Ducati would be only maybe scoring 9 or 10 points if Giuliano takes 6th or 7th. Whereas this season, of course, Chas crashed out of Aragon Race 1 and they still had Malandry there to take 2nd and 20 points for the Manufacturers' Championship. So Ducati are still, they're still in the mix there. They're still only 24 points behind Kawasaki in the Manufacturers' Championship, despite seeing Kawasaki take 5 wins in a second. All of their points have been scored by Jonathan Rea. You won't be at all surprised to hear.
Yep.
And Ducati have had 4 seconds, a 3rd and a 1st. So they're right there, but Jonathan Rea is just making the difference there at the moment in that inter-team battle. We've covered Sykes. Let's cover the Yamahas now, who, if you look at Yamaha's Manufacturers' Championship list of results, 4th, 4th, 5th, 4th, 4th, 5th. Over the course of the 6 races we've seen so far, that's a combination of the results of Lowe's and Vandermark, and they continue to be the nearly guys, don't they, Dre? Yamaha, they're nearly there. They're just close enough to sort of pick up the pieces if some guys ahead of them fall off, but they're just not quite in podium contention yet.
They're not quite there yet, and again, it's a shame because they've clearly made real progress, and Crescent Racing deserve all the props in the world for that. They really are getting there, and like, again, we'll talk about this in BSP in an hour on, but it looks like they've got a solid R1 this year by the looks of it. And again, they're doing a good job. It's just they're not quite on the level of Ducati and Kawasaki just yet. And yeah, I mean, it's in the middle place, because we all know Yamaha really wants to win. That's why they came back into Worlds in the first place, and we jumped the gun on them when they first came back, and it ended up being such a disappointing season for them, but it looks like they've got a very good foundation to build on right now. Lowe's is having a very good season, despite the false neutral concerns, and yeah, the reliability's been a little bit of a letdown for them so far as well, given that Vandermark missed the race or missed the restart because of what happened in Thailand as well. So again, they've got issues there that do need resolving to an extent, but the pace is there, and these race twos, Yamaha are continuing to, you know, become a thorn in the side for guys like Ray, Sykes, Kawasaki's and Ducati's in general. So if like being the best of the rest right now, there's no real shame in that, because Kawasaki and Ducati are the class of the field right now, and they have work to do to get up to that point.
Yeah, look at who they're ahead of. Yamaha, that's what I'd say. Look at some of the teams and some of the bikes that they're beating at the moment. It's only that big four that are just on another planet that the Yamaha can't quite live with. And it is kind of telling, isn't it, with Yamaha, where if you look at they've had 3 double front rows, if you like, now for race twos this season, and twice now Alex Lowe's has been on race two pole, and he put up more of a fight this time, didn't he? It took him a few laps, he was leading Jonathan Rea until he got pulled back in, but it just goes to show that they've still got a little bit of work to do, that they're still not in a position yet where they can convert that double front row into a result in race two. They still just kind of fall back as the race goes on. It just takes a bit longer this time.
Yeah, it does. And yeah, like you say, their top level pace is up there with the best. It's just they don't think they can carry themselves that way around an entire race distance yet. And I think in time they'll get there. And again, they've got 2 very, very good riders right now, and they've both had great performances so far this season. Vandermark and Lowe's are doing as much as I think the bike can give them, really, at this point in time. So yeah, I mean, you can't sniff at genuine improvement, and they really have. They are now clearly the 3rd best bike in the field right now. It's just a matter of if they can find another 2 or 3 temps and they can maybe take advantage of the new system, they could get podiums on a regular basis. I really do think they could do that by the end of the season if they can really, you know, work themselves into a good position like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when, from Vandermark's point of view, we've got Acid next. So he'll have that one penciled in, not just because it's home run, but he'll have that one down as a big opportunity to get a result, given that he would often be a race-winning contender on the Honda, on the old Honda, Vandermark. So what can he do on that Yamaha in a few weeks' time when World Superbikes heads to his home round? That's going to be fascinating to see. And as you say, for Alex Lowes, he had his first bot, really, on his copybook for this season, where he's been so consistent and so strong. But as it transpired after the race, his first crash in a race this season wasn't actually his fault.
Yeah, exactly. Seems it was a false neutral that caused it, unfortunately. We saw Jonathan Rea have a couple of these last season, and that caused him to fall off the bike as well. So, yeah, it seems to be a little niggling issue there with the Yamaha, but hopefully, with a little luck, it was just a one-off, because it's a shame, because Lowes was running very well in that race as well before that happened. It was very unfortunate.
Yeah, he's doing very, very well. Let's talk about a couple of homeboys from Aragon, two of the Spaniards who had good weekends, starting with Jordi Torres, the Spanish Elvis himself, who continues, Dre, to do the Lord's work on that BMW. If only that team had some factory support, eh?
I know! We've not mentioned this before at all!
Sixth
in race one. Jordi Torres is doing a fantastic job on that Altea BMW. It's again, as we mentioned, BMW does not provide factory support to the Altea team despite using their S1000RRs, which is really unfortunate because, yeah, right now as it stands, they're very, very good. They are very, very good indeed. And again, Jordi Torres he's becoming that perennial guy that gets best out of not so good machinery guy. And like maybe he's taking pages out of the Alicia Spagaro playbook at this point. Because he was very good as a rookie at Aprilia when he was alongside a very talented Leon Haslam. He held his own against him on multiple occasions, had a race win, you know, was on the podium multiple times. Again, his World Superbike resume has been nothing but good stuff since he got there from Moto2. And I would like to see someone take a chance on him in a better team at some point, because he's not put a foot wrong since he got into the class. And he's leading that team into places where the bike probably doesn't deserve to be right now. And I hope BMW doesn't fall down the order as time goes on and as other factories improve and develop, because that's something that BMW might not be able to do, which is a shame, because, again, you've got a very good young team there with Torres and Reiterberger, and Torres is doing a fantastic job.
Yeah, they're a bit of a crossroads, I think, the Altea team. So it was one of the, I remember reading a story over the course of the weekend from an Italian website about Altea from the team boss, who said that the team's got a decision to make now, because I think his exact quote was, or it was translated across, so basically it was worse to the effect of, we don't want to be a customer anymore, looking ahead to 2018. So Altea may have decisions to make later season. I think they're going to certainly sort of try and try their luck and try and force their hand with BMW and try and get a bit of factory support, because I don't think they want to drop BMW, because there's clearly the makings of a good bike there in the S1000RR. So I don't think they want to drop them, but I think BMW are definitely one of the teams that are perhaps having a look at the new Suzuki to see how it... Altea, look at that new Suzuki, see how it goes in BSB, see if there's the makings of a good bike there, and they may take that on, because they're almost in that McLaren-Honda boat, aren't they, Dre? Or McLaren, before they went to Honda. Do you potentially pass up a bike that's good and that's going to get you some good results, some solid results, and risk getting a bike that might actually be worse initially, but maybe better in the long run? That's almost the position Altea are at now. Do they risk giving up the BMW, which gets them some solid top sixes, and try and risk it for a bike that might get them better than that?
Oh no, not this! Like that's the worst decision you can ever make as a satellite team. It's do you give up the seven out of ten for what's in the mystery box? It's never
the only option on the table for them would be the new Suzuki.
You'd think, yeah. I mean, again, I think everybody will be watching Sylvain Guintoli this season very closely in BSB, because that is going to be essentially the company yardstick for what their bike is going to be. And yeah, I think that might be the only option at this point, because only one major entity is running that Suzuki right now, and the BMW is solid, but BMW are not interested in biking right now. So that, like, they're focusing more on European motorsport, GT3, etc. So as it stands,
are they getting involved in Formula E now as well?
Yeah, they've got a Formula E. They got an entry lined up now for season 5 of Formula E in 2019. So, 2018-19 season, I suppose, because it carries over to Christmas break and all that. But yeah, you get the gist. Yeah. It's one of those things where, as it stands, like, BMW are a good thing, they're not a great thing, and I'm not sure where the viable replacement right now. There's no sure thing in going to somewhere like Suzuki right now, where we don't know where they would fit into a world's paddock right now. And let's be honest, the last time Suzuki was in World Superbikes, it wasn't that great.
No, just that's Alex Lowe's and Randy Depardieu. But yeah, I sympathise with them. I really do, because let's be real. If then that BMW remains a customer bike, they're not going to win on it. They're just not. So it may be worth them taking the gamble, because Altea want to win. You know, they're a team that has won this championship before with Carlos Checa, so they're not a team that wants to exist as a customer. Yeah, as I say, the team boss pretty much spoke out on the Aragon weekend and said that, you know, they're pretty much done being a customer team now. They want to compete and they want to try and compete at the front. I think it's pretty much proven now. Even in World Superbikes, Dre, which isn't quite the same sort of technical exercise that MotoGP is now with the prototype bikes, you still need a factory bike to win.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. In both domestic and world superbike leagues, you need that factory backing. Customer teams don't win enough, unfortunately. It happens in MotoGP on occasion, and last year was kind of a freak year in that regard for satellite wins, but that's not the form, that's not normality, that's not what anything in bike racing is right now. You need that factory backing, and the sad reality is right now is that, yeah, at the moment, there's no real chance of a satellite team that has enough firepower to beat what's coming out of a factory. That's just how it is. And no factory would ever really let that happen because, well, they don't want to take credit for somebody else's win. They want the factories to put it on their social media that, yeah, we have a bike that won this, this, and this, not the satellite team. Well, if Yamaha had their way, they would never let Tech 3 win a MotoGP title, for example, as good as Johann Zarco may have been in Qatar. But it's one of those things where, as it stands right now, you're not going to have a satellite win. So you need a factory. That's just how it is right now in bike racing, because more and more are getting back involved in motorsport now.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, we'll follow that story with interest as it goes on, because I don't think we've heard the last of that from Altea as they try and find themselves a strong package for 2018. We've praised one Spaniard in Jordi Torres. Let's praise another, Dre, in Xavi Forrest, who did a great job on the opening weekend of the season in Australia at Phillip Island, where he had a couple of top sixes and looked like he had genuine podium pace for a lot of that weekend. And he deserves a lot of credit here, too, for finishing sixth in race two at Aragon, despite an uncomfortable experience, shall we say, at the end of race one.
Yeah, comfortable experience, and just to say the least, to quote one of my old favourite YouTube channels, the show Is It a Good Idea to Microwave This? Nobody likes roasted nuts. I have to applaud Xavi for holding on to the bike for as long as he did, despite the fact that there was a raging inferno going on.
On a fireball.
Yeah, he was literally sitting on a fireball. It was like, it's not like it was Taylor McKenzie who he saw a couple of years ago where he just hopped off the thing as soon as he could see on fire. No, Xavi held on to that damn thing for as long as he possibly could. Props to the fireproof levers. They are clearly very effective, given that he was almost barbecued and he still came back the next day and rode a very good race too. Do you see Cat need to stop catching fire, quite frankly?
Yeah, I had a chance last year.
Yeah, I know these Panigales are quick, but like these fires, they're not exactly what you call ideal, to say the least. But props to Xavi for being as safe as he possibly could, despite the fact there was a raging inferno going on underneath him. Again, I would not have blamed if he jumped off that thing as soon as he possibly could. But he rode it out to safety and then, again, came back the next day and had a fantastic race too. So props to Xavi. He's a braver man than me.
He is. It reminds me of an old Formula One moment back in 2009 with Rubens Barrichello in the Braun, where he's at Spa on the last lap. His engines catches fire. And Jock Clear, his engineer, comes on the radio and says, "Rubens, you're on fire." And Rubens is like, "Thanks." He goes, "No, you're on fire, like properly on fire." It was one of those where Xavi Forrest actually was having a very, very good weekend. So he'd be excused for being told, "Hey, you're on fire, mate." But he actually genuinely was last weekend at Aragon. But yeah, he came back the next day despite some, yeah, he must have been feeling slightly sore in a few areas, one particular sore area, and came out to finish sixth on the Sunday. So props to him for that. Here's how the Aragon weekend finished then. Race one went to Jonathan Rea by a pretty comfortable 4 seconds at the end, but that doesn't tell the story given that his main rival fell a lap from home. Marco Melandi taking second. Tom Sykes third. That's his third straight third place in race one. So that's 3 weekends in a row now where Sykes has gone without a lap of finishing on race two pole and blown it without a lap from home. From no fault of his own this time, though. He was promoted to third. Lowe's got the race two pole for fourth, ahead of Vandermark and Torres. Leandro Mercado, who was probably one of the unsung heroes of the weekend, given that it was his first ride of the season, because he's been injured from pre-season, he's riding for the IODA team, who were clearly so skinned that they decided not to replace Mercado for the first two rounds while he was injured. He's on an IODA Aprilia, and he beat the Milwaukee Aprilias in both races. Mercado getting seventh in race one, ahead of Eugene Laverty on the Milwaukee bike. Then came Bradle, who had his best weekend so far in World Superbikes, beating Hayden in both races. He was ninth in race one with Hayden. 10th, Camier, who had another disastrous start to the weekend with very little running prior to the races. Camier got 11th in race one on the MV Agusta. Race two, Davies beating Ray this time with Melandri third, Sykes in fourth. Then came Vandermark in fifth. Alex Lowe, as mentioned, had that false neutral, which saw him crash. He ended up 12th. Xavi Forres getting sixth ahead of Torres and Mercado, again beating Laverty. They were 8th and 9th. And Camier into the top 10 this time in 10th place. Then came Ramos, Bradle, Lowe's, Krumenacker, and Julian Simon, the former 125 champion, who replaced the injured Lorenzo Savadori. He got points in both races. Savadori, of course, who had that horrendous crash at Thailand where the bike leaked some oil on his rear tyre and sent him skywards. He's still not recovered from that, and he missed both races at Aragon. We hope to see him back at Assen in 3 weeks' time. Now on to World Super Sport then. This is Supersport 600, incidentally. We'll come on to the 300 class in a little bit, which had its first race of the weekend, first race ever in its history at Aragon last weekend. But it was the third World Supersport race of the season, Dre. And we've had two pretty batshit crazy races, as we call them, in World Supersport so far this season. Turns out we're 3 from 3.
Yeah, turns out we're 3 for 3. This was another hectic weekend from the qualifying and whatnot. It was all sorts of just crazy behavior, really. For example, Jesus Gazelle not even getting into Super Bowl 2 and having to start from 13th, etc. It was another one of those crazy weekends. We had a big leading battle at the front, and multiple leaders back and forth everywhere, multiple crashes, incidents, you name it. This race had it. We're 3 for 3 for batshit crazy, and Supersport is determined to put on as good a show as the big boys. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it's glorious. It's glorious this year, World Supersport. I'm absolutely loving it. It's not a championship that I've really paid a lot of attention to in the past, pretty much because it's just Keenan Softwell Glue's basically world, and the rest are living in it. But this season, it's fantastic. And yeah, to Dre's point, it kind of all started on Friday, where we had rain in the afternoon. It kind of started to rain just towards the end of Superbike FP2, which meant that Supersport FP2 was a washout. And as a result, given that the Super Pole sessions are cut off after Friday's two sessions, it was only the free practice one session that set the field for Super Pole, which meant that we had the championship leader, Robbie Rolfo, in Super Pole 1, Luca Mahias in Super Pole 1, Karakasulo, the Thailand winner in Super Pole 1, Cluzel in Super Pole 1, Kyle Ride was in Super Pole 1, Anthony West was in Super Pole 1, Luke Stapleford was in Super Pole 1, and it goes on. It was probably the most loaded first session ever, and only two advanced out of that session. Robbie Rolfo, keeping the dream alive, he got through all that to take a spot in Super Pole 2. Mahias did the same. He got through to Super Pole 2, which meant that the likes of Karakasulo and Cluzel had to start on the fifth row of the grid for the race itself on the Sunday into Super Bowl 2. And Jacobson, PJ Jacobson, who was quickest on Friday, he took pole position ahead of the returning Keelan Sofwoglu, who, despite not having ridden for 3 months, still puts it second on the grid, ahead of Sheridan Marias. Luca Mayas came through to take fifth on the grid, having got through Super Bowl 1. His nearest championship rival, or Rolfo's nearest championship rival, should I say, Iki Tudi, qualified in 7th place, with Rolfo just ahead of him in 6th. Into the race itself then, and I guess the key moment of this, Dre, came not indeed with what happened at the fight for the wings, we'll come on to that in a bit, but really what happened midway through, where Federico Caracasillo had made good progress, got himself into that leading group, and yet he looped it at turn 1, his second crash in 3 races. And whereas at Phillip Island he took out Cluzel, the championship contender, this time he took another one. The returning Sofwoglu had nowhere to go.
Yeah, Mr. Fogarty was like currently on the bins it, and then he's drifting wide towards that turn two apex, and Keenan has got nowhere to go. The bike is sideways on the ground at this point. He falls over the top, and he may have actually re-hurt himself a little bit on that bad
guy who didn't need to crash. It was him.
No, exactly. He was already probably not at 100% to begin with, given he's coming back from that nasty hand injury, and he's had to fall on it to protect himself instinctively after being collected essentially by Caracasulo's falling bike. And Keenan's season is really not going according to plan here, and now he might have a threat that nobody really saw coming in Lucas Mejias as well. We'll get to that in a minute, but just an awful bit of luck for Keenan there. His season has not even gotten going yet, and now all the rivals we were expecting to score points are now starting to score points, and that might be a problem too.
Yeah, it is, and we ended up with a three-way fight for the win at the end of it between Luca Mejias, the aforementioned Sheridan Marias, which made it a tricky one for the commentators with two very similar sounding names on very similar looking bikes, and PJ Jacobson on the MV. Now, we talked earlier about how factory teams don't want their bikes to be beaten by older bikes. Very nearly had it at the weekend because Sheridan Marias is on the old Yamaha R6 for the Callio Racing Team. He's the teammate to Nicky Tooley at the Callio team. Luca Mejias is on the brand new full-fat factory Yamaha R6 for the factory team, and they very nearly got beaten by Mejias on the old bike. Mejias just pipped him one corner out,
a fantastic cutting down the inside move from Mejias into the final corner. It's the kind of corner where you could take multiple lines through it if you know what you're doing, and Mejias was able to just sneak underneath and carry the momentum through, winning by 14 thousandths of a second, which is basically a foot, say to speak, for Mejias on that one. It was a tremendous last move, but again, Mejias did a fantastic job on that year-old bike. He was in control for the majority of that race. And again, if you hadn't known any better, you would not have guessed that was last year's R6 on there. Mejias did a fantastic job.
Yeah, brilliant job. His teammate Tooley, by the way, who was second in the championship heading to the weekend, he had a crash, didn't finish. So he didn't score. So he's lost ground in the championship. We'll tell you the standings in a second. You're absolutely right on Mejias, because he recognised that, because of course Aragon's one of those circuits where the finish line is very close to the final corner. So it's not like that move wouldn't have worked at a place like Qatar, where you've got a long, long run out of the last corner. And he recognised that if he could just get out of that final corner ahead, he'd probably make it to that line first. Because, of course, he got out of that last corner ahead, and then Mejias was just reeling him back in. And, of course, if the finish line had been another sort of 10 metres further down the road, then Mejias would have probably won the race. But Mejias brilliantly tactically judged to recognise that if he'd just gone out of that last corner ahead, he'd probably get to the line first and beat Mejias to the finish. And he did that, as you say, by 14 thousandths of a second. Jacobson got third. He just didn't have the top end on that MV to really make a play for the win ahead of those two Yamahas, which just had a little bit more on him down that long back straight. And Cluzel on the Honda, which didn't blow up this time and didn't get hit by another bike. So Cluzel, despite being knocked out in Super Bowl 1, having to start 13th on the grid, came through to 4th. And as you say, with Sofoglu not scoring, his expected title contenders, Jacobson and Cluzel, are now starting to get those points on the board. Cluzel getting his first of the year. Dre, you may be muted.
My bad, I did it again. I think it's like at least once an episode now. It's really annoying. I leave my microphone muted at one point. But yeah, Cluzel needed a break, and I'm glad he finally got it. That was a really good performance from Cluzel to come through from 13th on the grid to finish in 4th. Superb result. And it's a shame he didn't have the time to run at the front. And you know, again, he was the victim of that ridiculously stacked qualifying session. But Cluzel needed points badly, and I'm glad he finally got a clean break and got that 4th place and took home 13 very viable and very valuable points, because, yeah, he needed it for the title race. And that's the thing. The blessing of this season for him has been that, hey, he may not have scored, but the only person that really has benefited from this whole crazy first quarter of the season really has been Robbie Rolfo and Mejias. So, yeah, you know, take the 30 points where you can get them.
Absolutely. And to finish off on World Supersport, we have to talk about this guy because I think we're adopting him now as our Bike Live's actual sort of favourite rider now in World Supersport. The dream is still alive, Dre, for Robbie Rolfo, who came out of Super Bowl I. He didn't get a lap in on Friday because he was last after free practice one. It was wet in P2, so he didn't get a lap in there. So he had to start. He was actually quickest in free practice two because it was wet. It didn't count for Super Pole. So he had to go through this first session. He made it through against the likes of Caracasulo and Cluzel. Got himself into Super Pole 2 and qualified sixth. And finished sixth in the race. 10 valuable points. And even though he's lost the championship lead, he's only 5 off the lead now.
Absolutely, and like Rolfo's not going away.
The
ripe old age of 36, Rolfo seems to have—he's discovered the fountain of youth. Yeah. At this point, it's very impressive what he's doing for a man of his age on a very very talented super sport field like with the likes of Clistel. And a customer MV with the likes of PJ Jacobson, who's on the factory bike, Clizel, who's on a Honda, and then you've got obviously Keenan, the greatest ever in that category. And who's a prime title contender? Robbie friggin' Rolfo right now. Fantastic. It's inspiring stuff to see Robbie Rolfo, to see him that high up the field. I hope it continues because he's not going away right now. It's great.
No, the Leicester City of bike racing. Robbie Rolfo. God love him. Let's hope he can keep it up. Here's how the championship looks there. Maias takes the lead of it now with 45 points. 5 clear of Rolfo in second. Maias up to third from 10th to third with that second place at the weekend in Aragon. He's on 34, so he's 11 off the lead. Then comes Kyle Ryan, who stays in fourth. He came from way back on the grid to finish eighth. I think he was 18th on the grid, was Kyle Ryan. He was one of those that didn't make it out of Super Bowl 1. Yes, he was. 18th on the grid up to eighth for Kyle Ryan. So another great showing for the young Brit. Tooley, who failed to score, drops to fifth. He's on 27, so he draws the leader by 18. Jacobson is up to sixth. That's a climb of 6 places. Caracasulo drops from third to seventh. He's only got the 25 points that he got in Thailand. He looped it at the other two races. Decker Kreisart, the wildcard, he was second to Caracasulo there. He's still 8th in the points on 20. So top 8 covered by 25 points. So any of the top 7, given that Kreisart's not going to race again, any of the top 7 could lead Assen next round as championship leader, which is incredible. Wagner is 9th. Aidan Wagner, the Aussie, he's 9th in the points despite not scoring at the weekend. Anthony West, who didn't score but did take part at Aragon. Fortunately, his bike barbecued itself in Super Pole. He's still 10th in the championship after that podium at the first round. Then comes the Japanese Watanabe and Akubo, who are 11th and 12th. And Cluzel is now on the board. He is 13th in the championship on 13 points. He trails the championship leader, Mahias, by 32 points. And Sofwoglu Dre, who now trails obviously by 45, having still not got off the board. When he came back for the start of this Aragon weekend, you could still argue he was championship favourite, given that his rivals hadn't really taken advantage. But that lead is starting to stretch out now, given that he's made his return and still not scored. He's now got a 45-point gap to make up on Mahias, who might not actually be going away.
Yeah, Mahias actually looks like he's a top 3 level rider in the class right now. Again, if he was in the leading pack when his engine blew up in Thailand too, Mahias could have very easily have had 70 points by now. So when you look at a situation like this and you go, oh, wait, Keenan's going to have to probably win 5 or 6 races to even have a chance at this title now. When Mahias is not going away, he's scoring podiums and he's scoring high-ranking results when he is got a healthy bike around him. So as it stands right now, yeah, Mahias might be the big threat here.
Yeah, he might well be championship favourite right now, given that he's got 19 points on Jacobson. He's got 32 on Cluzel and 45 on Sofwoglu. So we may have a point where the three of them, kind of like Rossi and Lorenzo MotoGP last season, where they just neither of them could really give chase to Marquez because they kept beating each other up. We might get that kind of scenario this season if neither one of the three can put a consistent run together. And the less consistent it is, the more mixed up it is. That now favours Mahias and Rolfo, doesn't it, at the front, who've got the points. If the field keeps getting mixed up and they keep getting consistently sort of top 6 results, that might well stand them in very good stead this season. Next round, as I say, World Supersport supports all of the World Superbike rounds with the exception of Laguna Seca. So the next round of that is an Assen at the end of April. Brand new class debuted at Aragon last weekend. The Supersport 300 World Championship made its debut, its long-awaited debut at Aragon. First ever win went to the Dutchman, Scott Daru, in a 3-bike fight, just 0.1 covering the top 3 across the line. It was a very, very close finish in World Supersport 300. We need to give this time, don't we, Dre, this new class, to sort of let it play out and let it sort of establish itself. But as a first impression, what did you make of it?
I thought it was decent. I didn't realise just how unpowerful these bikes were to only have 40 horsepower. So, yeah, I did think they looked slow on television, yeah, but at the same time, I mean, at the same time, yes, they have barely any power at all. And two, well, Aragon is huge. It's an enormous racetrack where even the fastest bikes in the world are barely doing it in a minute 50 or so. So, yeah, it probably wasn't the most ideal showcase in the world for a brand new series, especially one with a lack of power in it and one that's going to be about smaller bikes like Yamaha, like R3s, for example. But despite that, like, it was a good show, especially from the leading group. I'm glad we had a good battle for with it at the front. It's a shame that a lot of the field was so disjointed, but again, this was the first ever race weekend for these guys competitive. There's always going to be guys that adapt slower than some others, and I think in time, I think it will shake itself out and we'll get something quite decent here.
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, because I posted on Twitter on the Monday, the day after the race, that it was a good first weekend, but, you know, stuff to improve on. And Greg Haynes actually did tweet me to say, what would you improve? And I was like, well, I think a lot of the stuff that I wouldn't necessarily improve, I think it will just improve naturally over time in this class. Because the first thing that struck me, like you, was these bikes look slow. When I was watching it in Super Pole, but I think obviously when the bikes were running together in a race, they just raced a lot better and you didn't really notice it. But yeah, they looked really slow. Like where the World Superbikes sort of on those sort of sideways panning shots, the World Superbikes just whizzed through the frame. The Supersport 300 bikes were almost like watching a cruise ship go past, which wasn't a great look. And that long back straight Aragon doesn't really showcase them too well. And I think on circuits like Assen, Imola, Donington Park later this season, perhaps Misano as well, Jerez in particular, I think that those bikes will showcase the Supersport 300s a lot better, where there's less straight line and much more corners, and much more sweeping corners where the bikes can follow, and we get to see the best of these bikes in a Supersport 300 race. I also think the bikes will naturally just get quicker as the riders learn them, because it really did strike me how sort of slow the lap times were. Like, I think the Moto 3 lap record is sort of like a 159 or something like that, but the Supersport 300s were doing a 212.
Yeah.
Around, so they're basically doing what the Moto 3 bikes were doing in the wet around Aragon back in 2012, which is a very, very big gap. But again, it's their first race. I agree with you. The gap between the front and the back of the field was way too big. And that's the kind of, I was kind of thinking to myself this on Monday. I was thinking, well, how strong is the field naturally going to be here? Because if there's any rider of world championship level at this kind of age, they're going to be racing in Moto 3 if they're going to be racing anywhere, aren't they? So they're not just going to be sat on the sidelines waiting for a Supersport 300 class to appear and racing that. So I think we need to give this class a bit of a chance in that it's going to take a couple of years really for the riders. Supersport 300 have got to be identifying riders at like 11, 12, 13 years old now, haven't they, to get into Supersport 300 in the future. Because any rider that's 16 or 17 right about now that is on that top tier level is going to be in Moto 3. They're like the Bulliger, Mia, Canet, etc. They're not going to be raised. They're not going to be sat around waiting for Supersport 300, are they? So you're pretty much going to have the best of the rest of that age group in Supersport 300 right now. So I think that's kind of, again, you have to kind of factor that in when we look at the gap between the front and the back, because the guys at the back were sort of 10 seconds a lap slower than the guys at the front, which is just way too big for any class. But again, give it time and that may change. One of the criticisms I'd have of Supersport 300, I don't think they should be using the Super Pole format. I really don't think they should be using that because it just does not give these kids enough track time. It really doesn't. They weren't helped by the fact that free practice 2 on Friday afternoon was rained off. So all they get in Supersport 300 is 2 half-hour practice sessions on a Friday, and then they're into Super Pole. That's it. And Super Pole is 2 15-minute sessions. So if you get knocked out in Super Pole 1, or you're in Super Bowl 2, you're only going to have 2-30 minute practice sessions and then a 15 minute qualifying, and then that's it, and then you're racing on the Sunday. And it was no coincidence to me that the race winner and the pole sitter came out of Super Bowl 1 in Scott DeRue. He got through the first session, then put on pole position and won the race, and I just wonder whether, because he had more laps than anyone else on the bike, whether that just really helped him. at the weekend. So for me, if I was running World Supersport 300, I would just get rid of the Super format and just give them a 45-minute qualifying session. And just give them all the time they need to learn these bikes, because that's what they need right now. They need time to learn these new machines. And it was basically the riders that learned the quickest who had the advantage the weekend. So a very, very good first impression for World Supersport 300, because the race was brilliant. We had a race won by Debrue by 47 thousandths of a second, with Mika Perez third on the Honda, 0.1 off the win. So there are definitely positives to take from this. I guess another positive, Dre, from Supersport 300 was the 1-2-3 across the line were Debrue on a Kawasaki Ninja 300, Danny Valle on a Yamaha R3, and Mika Perez on a Honda CBR 500. So one thing they've certainly achieved is parity between the different bikes.
It's a good sign. It's a good sign. But God, you were on a tirade right there, son. Holy crap! I mean, look, I can't. By the way, let me know. I didn't disagree with a single thing that Lewis said on that one. Again, track time is the most important thing for these guys. If you want to see an established series break out here, and you want to see who's really good and who isn't, you should be giving these youngsters as much time on track as possible, and you let the natural balance of the field shake itself out a bit more. I mean, seeing a guy come through and take pole from Super Pole 1 and then win the race probably isn't the best advertisement for your series going forward. It's like, oh, wait, the guy that qualified originally in 13th came through? That's not a good look. So, yeah, ultimately, I think you're right. I think they should just have a straight 45-minute qualifying session, give them as much track time as they can, tell the teams to go out there, put a race tire on the bike and go, you know what, do laps. Get as many laps in as you can, basically. Do a racing if it comes down to it, you know. Establish what you've got, because it's all a matter of learning. That's the nature of a brand new series. I hope they were given a healthy amount of testing time, if not, give them more of it, because you don't want to see races ultimately every week where, sure, you might have a battle for the lead, but there's four guys that are better by 10 or 11 seconds than the other 15 behind them. That's not necessarily what you want for a series either, because I do think they were aiming for something like Moto3 here, and they might miss the mark if they keep up with things like that.
Yeah, they kind of got it at the front, didn't they, with that four-way fight for the win, because Borja Sanchez was just 0.8 off the win in fourth. It's funny though, even though it's not Moto3, it's Supersport 300, we still had three Spaniards in the top four in Supersport 300. So yeah, that's one thing they've picked up from Moto3. The Spaniards look very, very good in it. Although they were beaten by a Dutchman at the weekend. But yeah, I totally agree. Give them a 45-minute qualifying session, give them track time, because again, in a place like Aragon, where they're doing 2:12 laps, that Superpole 1 session, that's what, 6 laps if you look at it? If you're one of the first out of the pit lane, you're going to get 6 laps in.
Yeah,
which is nothing. And even in those 30-minute practice sessions, you're going to get maybe 10 or 12 laps, because you're going to have to come in the pits at some point to make changes to your bike, and then you've got to go back out again. So, yeah, I think obviously not every circuit is as long as Aragon, which again means that it will naturally improve. As I say, places like Donington Park and Imola and Jerez, I think, and Assen next up, I think these Supersport 300 bikes will go a lot better around there. And I think, as I say, as they all learn the bikes and get time on these bikes, the field will naturally close up a bit. But yeah, as a first impression, I thought it was great, but I think there is stuff to work on for Supersport 300. And if we give it time, I think that stuff will shake itself out. The result of that first race, as I mentioned, Scott Deroux the winner by 47 thousandths of a second from Danny Valle for Hal Courier Racing on the Yamaha R3. Mika Perez, last year's European Junior Cup champion, taking third on the World Sport Race Days Honda. Then Borja Sanchez, fourth for Hal Courier Racing on the second of the Yamahas, in fourth. Licciardi, the Belgian, was fifth on a Yamaha R3 ahead of Paolo Gracia, the first of the Team Italia riders, in sixth on the Kawasaki Ninja 300. Dugratola, another of the Italians, taking seventh. Lorero, the South African, eighth. Giacomini, the Italian, second of the Team Italias, in ninth. And Anat Carrasco of Moto3 fame, taking tenth, the Spanish girl, on the Kawasaki ETG racing bike. Another disappointing outing for the factory Yamaha team in this one. Of course, they won Supersport 600, very nearly got podiums in World Superbikes, and they had two riders fighting at the front in the Supersport 300 race, and both crashed out of the leading group. One of them, Mikita Kalinin, who came through Superpole 1 and put it on the front row, he crashed out of the leading group towards the end. So a mixed weekend for the Pata Yamaha team across all of the classes, because they finished a close second in Stock 1000 as well. That race won by the Italian Michael Ruben Rinaldi on the Aruba Ducati. Up next, then, we're going to look at the opening round of the British Superbike Championship, which got underway at Donington Park. So stay with us here on Bike Live. Okay, let's talk BSB then. Donington Park hosted the opening round of the British Superbike Championship, and boy, we've missed BSB. Boy, we've missed things like Jack Burnicle calling Peter Hickman Keith Hickman, and Josh Brooks. What do you call Josh Brooks? He called Josh Brooks the wrong name as well. He called Josh Brooks Jeff in race one. Never changed, Jack. Never changed. But what we got was we got a couple of races without the main protagonist in it, Dre. Shaky Byrne, who first of all, we didn't get a qualifying session, which was a shame because we had oil dumped all over the track on Saturday, and tragic events as well, which we'll come on to at the end of the show, which overshadowed things on the Saturday. So which it meant the grid was set by the free practice times over the course of Friday and Saturday. Shaky Byrne, of course, didn't start it because of a crash down the Crane of Curbs on Sunday. And British Superbikes doing basically the right thing, Dre, and looking out for its riders and basically pulling Shaky Byrne out of there.
I'm very glad they did. We talked about this in depth on our previous iteration on Downforce Radio, where we talked about Danilo Petrucci and Aragon last year, where, going by all accounts, it looked like he'd been allowed to continue with a concussion, and that could have been extremely dangerous and potentially fatal. So I'm glad that they gave Shaky the once over, found out they had a concussion-like symptoms, and they pulled him from the weekend. I'm glad they did that, because I'd rather have that, because the thing is, a lot of guys crashed this weekend. There was a lot of riders making mistakes, and if Shaky drops on his head and has an accident on one of those two races, he could die. Second impact syndrome. We mentioned it before on this show. So I'm very glad that BSB ultimately did the sensible thing and pulled Shaky out of the weekend for his own good, because I think Shaky was irritated that he couldn't ride. But for the good of him and the safety of himself and others around him, I'm glad they didn't run him for the weekend.
Yeah, and this is one of those areas where the showdown format allows him to do this as well. It allows him to miss around, because you can just make up those points later on, and as long as he gets in that top six by the time Silverstone comes around, he's still okay. So Shaky Byrne will hope to see back on Easter weekend when BSB returns at the Brands Hatch circuit when they're on the Indy layout. You know, Brands Hatch is basically Shaky Byrne territory. It's his home round, so expect him to look very, very good there. In his absence, it was kind of the stage was set, Dre, for Leon Haslam to try and take advantage, and he took advantage to the absolute maximum, didn't he? A double win, and he looked superb in both races.
Yeah, he absolutely did. Leon Haslam won both races basically in a canter. It was very comfortable out there. That Kawasaki is fast. Make no mistake, it's still an excellent bike, and Haslam just has this knack of putting the harder compound tyre on the bike and being able to make it work. He's so good at that. And again, he won both races, and I don't think he had to work particularly hard to win either of them, which was kind of almost like a subdued weekend, not only because of the fatal accident that we had earlier in the weekend, but also just the fact that the curiosity of where Shaky would have shook out in the field if he was able to run, because I fear that Ducati would have been right up the front in any case if Shaky was still on it at that point. It's a shame, but that's what it is. That's bike racing sometimes. And props to Haslam for taking full advantage of the situation and bringing home 50 points.
Yeah, he did. He looked very, very good. In both races, he just ended up, like, both races kind of looked as if they were shaking up to be kind of head-to-head battles. He had different opponents in the two races. It was Luke Mossy in race one. And just the longer the race went on, just the stronger Haslam got, where the other guys just couldn't quite last the pace with him as the races went on. And it's kind of an issue with the showdown format where over Shaky Byrne, who may well be his main rival, he's actually not gained 50 points. He's gained 10, hasn't he? He's gained 10 podium points. But that was kind of what undid Haslam last season, is that he didn't have as many podium points as Shaky, and then he lost those group points early on in the showdown when he crashed. Yep. So even if Shaky's not around, and even if Shaky does come back to make the showdown, Haslam's got to bank these podium points and bank the big.
Yep, exactly. So again, Haslam's just got to take these where they can get them, quite frankly. And again, it's an easy 10 podium point advantage right there, which is again two race wins basically. So hey, if I'm Haslam, you got to take these opportunities where you can get them. And you know, Shaky will be mad to a degree that he didn't get this. And it's a shame that the showdown format means that, you know, Haslam's not going to take a mega advantage away from a guy missing an entire weekend and Haslam doing the double. If this was Worlds, we'd be looking at a totally different conversation here. But that's the nature of the showdown format. So, you know, to each your own. You know, one hand giveth, the other taketh away, as I said to Lewis on Twitter at the time. You know, it's just a matter of, you know, just using the format to advantage you. And again, Shaky will bounce back at Brands Hatch, and, you know, we'll see how the true state of the field plays out from there.
Yeah, he will. And I guess one thing that the JG Speedfit Kawasaki team can take for the weekend, over and above Leon Haslam's double win, is that Luke Mossy is looking a real contender, as we kind of thought he would in 2017. Dre, he's second in the championship at the moment, 19 points by Leon Haslam, but following his teammate at home for a 1-2 in that first race and equaling his career best. He's had 1 second before in BSB. That was Alton Race 3 last season in the triple header in the summer round. And Luke Mossy genuinely does look like that kind of guy now, that he's going to get wins as the season goes on. He's looking a real threat now.
He absolutely is. I mean, again, he's basically on the factory Kawasaki now and not the satellite department with JG Speedfit jumping over, basically. It's a very, very good package. It's a package that's more than good enough to win multiple races a season. So one has to think Mossy will get his chance at some point. And it's a shame his race two wasn't quite as good. But race one, he was in the front. I know Haslam kind of broke off towards the end there in the second half of that race. So maybe Mossy might have to work in his ultimate pace a little bit more. Maybe push Kawasaki a little bit more and see where he can find a couple of attempts more. But he's got something there. And if he can come out straight away, first weekend of the season, and score a podium and, you know, have top fives in both races, that's a very positive sign for Mossy.
Yeah, it is a really positive sign. And he's, as I say, he's one of those guys that's looking to make the showdown. So he's already established himself in that top six, and he's got some podium points in the bank as well to go with it, with that second place in race one. Second position in race two, though, went to one of the international names that we spoke about last week, who's returned or moved to the British Superbike Championship from World Superbikes. And I think we all thought this already, Dre, before we even saw him turn a wheel. But God, it's good to have Josh Brooks back.
Yes, it's very nice to have Josh Brooks back.
The real Josh Brooks back. So I don't think we ever saw the real Josh Brooks in Worlds, did we?
No, not really. Again, it just wasn't a good team for him at the time, and you could tell quite early on that Brooks was never going to stand out in that Worlds field, given the BMW package he was on. But yeah, in any case, it's great to have him back where he belongs in BSB on a Yamaha, where he will be a contender. I have no question about that. That Yamaha is fast, make no mistake. Again, I think they seem to have tyre wear problems. I didn't notice that as the race would go on.
The McCams Yamahas did, didn't they?
Yeah, like Ellison his pace was great at the start, but he dropped like a stone in the second half of the race. But again, like the Yamaha will work on this. We saw it 2 years ago when Brooks won his title, and maybe some of the confidence that Brooks had in the bike wasn't misled, because yeah, you could tell that that Yamaha is fast, and it will be a contender for sure. Especially when Brooks, who probably knows that bike better than anyone else on the planet, quite frankly. So when you factor all that in, and you can see Brooks run very well in race two especially, yeah, it's great to have him back at the top.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many reasons why that was always going to work. But I'd say I was surprised, not about you, Drew, but I was surprised to see Brooks taking it to Haslam so soon this season. I kind of had a feeling in the back of my head that it would take a bit of time for that to work, given that it's a biker that he knows, but it's not a team that he knows. And it's a team in Anvil Haier Tag Yamaha that's not used to running up the front in BSB. I mean, last season with Rispoli and Sean Winfield, they were scraping into the points on a good day. So for them to be running at the front straight away just shows that not only is Brooks back at his best and in tune with that bike, but the team is really improving. Because they're running up at a part of the field that they've never ran at before. So credit to Anvil Haier Tag as well, because Sean Winfield got his first points as well. He got points at the weekend in both races. or he got points in race one, should I say. He got 15. So that team is doing a really, really good job for Josh Brooks. We also saw a couple of surprise podiums. As I say, we had Haslam taking two wins, Mossy second to him in race one, Brooks taking the fight to him in race two. And as I say, two surprise names joining them on the podium. Or should we be surprised, Ray, by Christian Iden getting a podium in race one, given that he always seems to peak in the early rounds of a season?
He did it last year where he led the championship for several races. Yeah, Iden has always been a good guy to get out of the blocks quickly. And this year made no exception. A very strong weekend for Christian Iden. Again, the question will be whether he's able to hold it down towards the showdown rounds, and maybe in the second half of the season we'll see if he can keep that form going. But again, very strong performance from Iden there to get on the podium.
Third and a fourth.
Yeah, very good result from Iden there.
That's how you lay the groundwork for trying to get into the showdown. Get regular top six results, which Absolutely. Is what Iden has done so far. So yeah, much like last year, it's a case of can he sustain this? Can he keep this going? Another guy who had two top six, this was Glenn Irwin, because he was sixth in race one and then came from almost nowhere in that second race. He really came on strong late in the race, in a race where it looked like we were going to have a fight for the podium between the likes of Iden, Luke Mossy, James Ellison as well. And then Irwin came on, went on a tear towards the end and overtook a lot of them late in the race. And that should really set alarm bells ringing at the likes of JDC Pit Kawasaki and the Yamaha teams, given that Shaky Burns' rather inexperienced teammate came flying through to third.
Yeah, that was a dangerous-looking sign there that Ducati have got something here, because we don't normally associate him with those kind of performances. And he stormed through in the second half of that race, was running leading-level pace with Haslam in the middle of the pack, siphoning his way through the field to get a podium at the end of the race two there. Very, very impressive stuff indeed from Glenn Irwin indeed. So if that's happening with Glenn on the second bike, and we all know he's nowhere near Shaky's level, if that's a thing, then Shaky is going to be right up there in the front, no question. Absolutely. But you could have probably guessed that.
even at the age of 40. But yeah, he is still that good. And yeah, we're not taking anything away from Glenn Irwin with his podium here as well, because he got a podium, I think, didn't he, right at the end of last season at Brands. He got his first podium in BSB on the weekend where Shaky won the title but didn't really figure in either of the three races, and Irwin got a podium. So he's definitely a rider that's got real ability, because he was one of those guys, along with the likes of Rispoli and guys like that, that were ringing at the front of British Supersport. Kyle Ride and Stapleford. Yep. Irwin was racing with those guys at the same time and keeping them honest. So Glenn Irwin is a class rider as well, and he will certainly, as time goes on, he'll be a front running contender too. But as you say, he's not Shaky. Very few people are. So as well as Glenn Irwin's done, you've got to feel that Shaky's going to be up there as soon as he returns from his injury, and given it's a concussion, we'd expect him to be back for the next round. At Brands Hatch, once he's had a little bit of rest in a couple of weeks on Easter weekend. Let's talk about a couple of the other international names then that have moved across from World Superbikes. We've already covered Josh Brooks, who returned and got a second place in race two. Sylvain Guittoli, bit of a mixed weekend, had a crash in race one, and of course found himself victim to the BSB rules where you can't remount and restart when you crash, as you can in Worlds. Not that he would have been able to anyway, I don't think, because the handlebar had snapped off his bike. Cal Crutchlow may try that, but I don't think Sylvain Guittoli is going to. But he came back in race two to get seventh, which doesn't sound great, Dre, but do we kind of have to look at Guittoli and the Suzuki team the same way we look at the Honda team, in that it's a brand new package and it's going to take a bit of time?
The Ginter's homecoming tour is on delay until further notice, until we actually build the stage. It's a bit of a problem. We've got to remember, this is Suzuki's first competitive running on a brand new bike. So we know it's not running anywhere else either. Yeah, exactly. So this is basically a glorified test demo for this new bike. So for Ginter's to finish in seventh place, all things considered, with some really top names ahead of him, that really isn't bad for a first competitive run-in. They'll only get better as time goes on and they discover more about this bike, because that was their first race weekend. So they'll only build on this for future reference. They now have test data of themselves in a race. They'll only get better as time goes on. And I don't think seventh is really that bad a result, given, again, that's right around the showdown sort of range. And, hey, Ginter's wasn't, you know, not top-tier competitive speed, but that's a solid result for their first time going. Again, especially given it's Ginter's first time in the class again for a good while. So on the whole, I don't think you can take too much, you know, negativity away from that. I think that was a pretty solid first run, especially given, if by the looks of it, they've already got something better than the new Honda Fireblade.
Yeah, look at the guys that were ahead of him. Gintoli, Haslam, Brooks, Irwin, these aren't slow guys.
Yeah, elite names
that are beating Sylvain. So and Giuliano, Davide Giuliano, the other on the Tyco BMW, of course, teammate to Iden, who had such a good weekend. Giuliano less so. He was 13th in race one. He was one of the guys who really did fade towards the end of the first race. Perhaps maybe he had tyre issues. He then got 9th in second race, Giuliano. Part of me was a little disappointed with that, given that this is a circuit that he has seen before. Of course, Worlds go to Donington because he got second last year to Sykes on the Ducati around Donington Park. So it's not like he's going to have the excuse of places like Cadwell Park and Knock Hill that he hasn't seen before, Giuliano. But I guess if anything, it just serves to illustrate just how much strength and depth this series has, that a guy who has been used to running at the front in World Superbikes turns up in BSB and can barely scrape top 10.
Yeah, again, BSB is not playing. Their field is, I've said it before, every bit as good as Worlds in many aspects. And Davide has always had that elite level World Superbike speed, but it's hard to translate in a field that's as stacked as this one. And it's not like the BMW isn't competitive. It's a competitive bike. It always has been. And the Tyco team has been, you know, in and around the showdown race for the last 2 or 3 years now. So it's going to take Davide some time to get used to the bike and get used to the series in general. And, you know, he's going around tracks he hasn't really gone around for a good while. But again, Donington was on the world's calendar too. So he knows Donington well. So I'm not saying it was a bad weekend from Davide. It was an okay first weekend from him. But yeah, it's more of a ringing endorsement for how good BSB is as a class.
Yeah, he's going to have to really work at it to learn, because obviously it's his first season on a BM as well. He's used to riding Ducati, so
absolutely.
There's a bit of a learning process to go for Davide Giuliano. Here's how the weekend shaped out then. Haslam, the winner of race one from Mossi and Iden. That was your podium. Fourth going to Peter Hickman, who's back on a BMW and going very, very well. He took fourth in race one ahead of James Ellison, who faded with tyre problems. Glen Irwin getting sixth ahead of Josh Brooks on the Yamaha. Lost a couple of places on the final lap, which dropped him to seventh. Then came Michael Lamerty on the second of the McCowan's Yamahas in eighth. Ninth went to Jake Dixon on the Kawasaki. And the top 10 was completed by somebody, because the championship standings aren't showing me. Second race went to Haslam ahead of Brooks this time. Brooks taking second place ahead of Glen Irwin, who came through to take his first dry podium in a British Superbike race. Fourth position in the end going to Iden, completing his solid weekend ahead of Luke Mossi, who couldn't quite match his race one exploits, and James Ellison taking sixth position. Jason O'Halloran getting two top tens on the Honda. He was the guy that finished 10th in race one, and that was about as good as it got for the brand new Honda Fireblade on its debut British Superbike weekend. They're another team that I think we're going to have to keep an eye on if they improve as the season goes on. It'll take them a bit of time to learn that new bike. How good was that livery, though? That's what we were saying about that new Honda, the red and silver on that new Honda Fireblade in BSB. It is an absolute beaut. So let's hope we see it somewhere near the front as the season goes on. Right, let's do the news before we go and talk World Superbikes again, because there's a couple of news stories to tell you about World Superbikes. First of all, from test team, because they tested. They stayed on Aragon on the Monday for the post-race test. And for the first time, I think, this season, we saw Tom Sykes on top of a session, because he beat Jonathan Rea. Kawasaki 1-2 in the test. Both of them were doing 149s around Aragon, which is kind of terrifying for the field. Tom Sykes taking the honours in that one ahead of Jonathan Rea, his teammate. Chas Davies not quite hitting the heights of Sunday. He ended up third overall on the day. His teammate Marco Melandri having a crash on that test day, so not the greatest of days for the Ducati team. Alex Lowe was also having a crash on the Monday. He was sixth overall with his teammate Michael Vandermark just ahead of him up in fourth. But Kawasaki continuing to just show their strength at the moment in World Superbikes, given how well they went over the race weekend. They were 1-2 in the test as well at Aragon last weekend. Other World Superbike news, and it surrounds discipline and the decision that MotoGP made a couple of weeks ago to ditch penalty points in their championships in favour of a kind of a more uniform structure of penalties. World Superbikes have done the same. They've ditched penalty points as well. And I mean, I don't think it's going to have as much an effect, Dre, in World Superbikes, because we seem to get less penalties in Worlds. But what do you think of this in general, ditching the penalty points? I mean, it kind of, the whole system kind of got exposed a bit when they kind of just gave Valentino Rossi as many penalty points as it took to give him a back of the grid penalty back at Valencia the year before last. It didn't seem as if there was a one-size-fits-all penalty point system in place. So in some ways, is it better the system scrapped altogether?
I think it is. I think it caused more problems than it was worth, really. I mean, look at, for example, what happened with Carol Haneke, where he took out Guevara after a race intentionally and got five. Well, how was that a five-point penalty? And how is this not as bad as Rossi doing something similar in actually in a race for 3 points? He's going, what warrants how many points, etc.? And when you, I think you're giving the stewards too much power at that point. And at that point, if there's not consistency, we're going to have questions, like with football refereeing and like stewarding in any sport. Like, if you're not consistent with how you referee a game or how you discipline your talent, then, you know, we're going to have questions. And I had a lot of questions regarding the penalty point system and what warranted 1 point, what warranted 2, 3, 5 in some cases. So for me, I don't think it was worth the trouble. I don't think there was anything wrong with the old system. I think the stewards in MotoGP are some of the best in the world. And I think most of the time, they've gotten it right when it comes to disciplining riders. For instance, like for example, with Simon Chetty, when you took out Pedrosa and you got a ride-through penalty. Like, I think I've not really had very many times in MotoGP where I've looked at a decision and gone, oh, that was wrong, that was a terrible call. Like, they, generally speaking, they get it right most of the time anyway. So have the confidence in your stewards to give out what they want to give out, not hide behind a flawed system. So for me, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, because when you've got the penalty point system, you almost like precedents get set, don't they? You almost like once you give a number of penalty points for one incident, you almost any time you get something similar, you feel that has to be the penalty. And no two incidents are the same in any motorcycle race, unfortunately. You've got to judge each one on its merits. And I think just giving them just free rein of penalties to basically give out whatever they see fit to give out, I think will be a good thing for World Superbikes. They've followed the MotoGP structure. MotoGP news, as we look ahead to this weekend's Argentine Grand Prix at Tomas de Hondo, we will be seeing Alex Rins, or certainly initially, because he has been declared fit, whatever that means, for the Argentine Grand Prix, despite Dre breaking his ankle in a training crash. That doesn't sound like the kind of injury you get over in a week.
No, it isn't. Like a broken ankle, if that's football, that can be weeks, that can be months, depending on how it's broken. So yeah, I mean that's a dodgy one. Luckily, ankles are not as bad in bike racing. I don't think anything's as bad as bike racing because these riders are idiots that will ride through anything. But in any case, that's not a 1 week recovery. That's a nasty injury. If that would happen to you or me, your foot will be in a cast for about a month. Mm-hmm. So that's not an ideal injury for Rins to take. Luckily, I think he'll only be operating a foot brake, so I don't think it'll be that bad. Just he might want to be careful in how he exits the bike. I pray to God he doesn't crash this weekend, because if he does, oh boy, that could be all sorts of painful.
Yeah, pray to God that we don't have a repeat of last year and a flag to flag where he's got to jump off one bike onto another.
Oh Lord!
You might find that a little tricky. You might lose a bit of time in the pits if he has to do that. This weekend. Let's get to the weekend then, and we don't want to be one of those podcasts or one of those shows in MotoGP that instantly decides that straight away, because we're talking MotoGP, we have to talk about Valentino Rossi. But we're going to on this occasion, Dre, because he's reaching a milestone this weekend, a milestone that nobody has ever reached in Grand Prix history. Valentino Rossi this weekend races in his 350th Grand Prix. as Chef's parents would say, he's reached Tree Fiddy Grand Prix in MotoGP.
Yes.
And what a milestone. Whatever we think of the guy, whatever we say about him, to race in that many races and still be arguably one of the top two, top three favourites to win the Grand Prix is one hell of an achievement.
yeah, still a perennial contender, and he turned 38 2 months ago. That's unbelievable. And say what you will about Valentino, I've never been anything short of in awe of what he's been able to achieve on a motorcycle, what he's done for the sport, and his impact will be everlasting in MotoGP for sure. 350 Grand Prix. I thought Alex Barros would have all those, like, most Grand Prix awards locked up for years on end, because he was still riding in the 2010s at some point. But that is an unbelievable achievement from Valentino Rossi, and he's showing no signs of slowing down. I mean, he's going to get to 400 by the time his career ends. He's still got two more seasons left, and that's if he doesn't want to re-sign. So he's going to get close to 400 by the time it's all said and done. So to put it into perspective, I think the F1 all-time appearance record is 328 from Rubens Barrichello. Don't quote me on that. That was purely from memory.
Yeah, but he holds the record, but I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it's 320-something. So, yeah, for Rossi to have 350 Grand Prix to his name, and this is, I think, his 20th season in the top class, in all forms of bike racing, that's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. So a salute to Valentino on yet another ridiculous milestone in his career.
Yeah, and you kind of feel it won't be the last if Valentino on his script writer has anything to do with it. Because was it Phillip Island 2014 where he won on his 250th start?
Yes.
He just has that knack of just marking these occasions with wins. So you just wonder whether he's going to do that, because he's won in Argentina before.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, that famous race where he chased down Marquez. This weekend's going to be an interesting one, isn't it, Drake? Because in many ways, this is a Marquez track. And we'll talk about Marquez in a second. But of course, this isn't a circuit that they test at regularly. So it's not like Maverick Viñales has any sort of Yamaha form around this place. He went very well here last year on the Suzuki before he crashed on that bumper poor judgment, as you named it, at turn one in the wet. So it's almost like we're starting again from zero, isn't it, with Viñales this weekend. Can he match that same level of dominance that we saw throughout testing at a circuit that he's never ridden the Yamaha on before?
We'll have to wait and see. It's a total crapshoot. That's going to be the fun part of Viñales this season. We don't know how his pace will carry over into certain tracks on this top-tier bike for the first time. In Qatar is very much a very straightforward sort of circuit. Argentina is very technical, and it's one that Marquez loves. And yeah, Marquez will definitely be the favourite going into this weekend, but Viñales is going to be the wild. He's going to be the wild card. He's going to be the X factor in this situation. I'm not sure how it's going to translate, but Yamaha doesn't tend to go that strongly around here. So
Lorenzo doesn't.
Lorenzo certainly doesn't. And if Lorenzo's struggling, then chances are Viñales might struggle too. We'll have to wait and see how it plays out. But this is a track that masks the Honda's issues quite well. So if Marquez can get the best out of the bike around here this weekend, he'll probably win. But if Viñales can take a podium from here, he'll happily take it, I think.
Yeah, because there's only one real big stop around Argentina, and that's that back straight to sort of turn five, I think it is, after that sort of tight, twisty first few corners, and then they go into the back straight. The corner where Marquez and Rossi clashed together a couple of years ago, that corner. That's the only real sort of corner that the Honda's likely to struggle at. Yeah, I think Marquez will be okay, because I had it explained brilliantly. I forget who it was. I think it was on the Paddock Pass, actually. The other week, where they explained the issues with Marquez and Honda, and the issues they had in Qatar, where, you know, because their bike is so bad in acceleration, they're trying to make up so much time on the brakes, which is just ruining their tyres, which is why you always see Marquez going for the harder front tyre, because he can't make the softer or the medium work, because he's working it so hard, trying to make up time on the brakes. So he won't have to do much of that in Argentina, which may well help him. And I guess, Dre, although it's very early, and Marquez, I mean, he's 12 points behind Viñales at the moment, we really are looking to Marquez this weekend, aren't we? Because for the last few years, we've always looked at Argentina and Texas as two banker Marquez weekends.
Yep, there are two banker Marquez weekends, and I don't see how that changes here, especially at COTA in next week on that back-to-back. But yeah, I think this is a very strong Marquez circuit, as you said. It masks a lot of those Honda-related problems very well indeed. And again, he's been a perennial powerhouse around here since its inclusion on the calendar in 2014, I want to say. I think it made its first appearance on the calendar. So I got a year one right for once. I'm normally a year out on these things. But yeah, it's a very strong Marquez circuit. And again, he'll be the favourite going in. And again, Marquez probably needs the win here, because this is the where, this is where he gets his points from. So let's see how it plays out.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see. Dovizioso is also talking about his chances this weekend. He says the Ducati goes well around Telmaster Hondo because he went very well for 99.9% of last year's race until, you know, they decided to skittle the pair of them out because they were on target for a 2-3 last year in this race. I mean, one thing we can only hope, right? I mean, I think we're going to get another race where the manufacturers are all pretty close together, because they were last year, it has to be said.
They were.
Vinales went very well before falling off. Crutchlow was up there, as well as Marc Marquez before he fell off. Iannone looked very good on the Ducati, so I would expect him to go very well on the Suzuki. It's another circuit where it's not going to best necessarily show up the deficiencies of the Aprilia, so we might see Aleix Espargaró go very well this weekend too. Which kind of makes you worry and makes you fear for Jorge Lorenzo, because he made no secret of the fact that he had a shocker in Qatar and doesn't like Telmaster Hondo all that much, because it's a circuit that's usually filthy dirty on a Friday.
Yeah.
And Lorenzo hates it when the grip surface is low. And that's kind of what Lorenzo's going to be faced with this weekend, isn't it?
Yeah, Lorenzo is a rider of confidence. And if a dirty track, because they don't race at the Argentina place very often over the course of a calendar year, so the track is most likely going to be quite dirty going into the weekend. And if grip levels are low, it hurts Lorenzo's confidence, and if Lorenzo has no confidence, he's not very fast. He is a rider of confidence. See the pattern here? But if that's going to continue, then Lorenzo might very well struggle around there again. He's not ever had a particularly good finish around here. He's been outclassed by Honda in the past. And, of course, he crashed last year.
Best
so
third, I think, in Argentina.
Yeah, exactly. He's never had a top two finish in Argentina to date. And given that how slow he was compared to his teammate in Qatar, which is a track known for balance in the books, that's not a good sign.
And Dovi does go well in Argentina. Well, he was second to Rossi in 2015 and would have been second last year had he known he not torpedoed him two corners out. So, look out for Dovi again this weekend. He's another guy. He's almost like Chris Nidden, isn't he, of the GP? He always starts the season very well. Like, you always look at the championship when we head to Europe and Dovi's up there somewhere, having had a few podiums early on. So, keep an eye out for him. Moto 2 and Moto 3, we're kind of just going to sort of watch and find out with everyone else, aren't we? Because we're still not quite sure how those seasons are going to pan out. We kind of know in MotoGP how the championship's going to figure. It's going to be the likes of Marquez, Vinales and Rossi going at it for the season. Once it's all said and done. But Moto 2 and Moto 3, we're still not quite sure yet. So the kind of questions are, can Morbidelli keep up his level of dominance from Qatar? And what the hell is going to happen in Moto 3? Because you could pretty much pick any one of a dozen riders for that one.
Sod Moto 3, I'm not wasting my time previewing a crapshoot. But in Moto 2...
At least Pauly can't curb stop them all this year.
Depends. Are we going to get rain again?
If he wins a Moto 2 race on his second time out, then we really are talking about a rain god.
Because the thing is that basically, I've seen the weather schedules. They're saying rain is in the air for Friday and Sunday on the bill for Argentina. So keep half an eye on that.
Hang on, Pauly. Hang on, let me check.
We're putting all our money on Danilo Petrucci. Pauly. Sod it. I'm going to be talking to you for my gold boat next week. But in any case, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Morbidelli, he was strong here last year before we crashed it too, if I'm not mistaken. I think he finished in... He was running in second place last year before the accident he had. Because, again, it was the bump of poor judgment, I think, that caught him out last season. So, Morbidelli will definitely be one to watch for this race as well. Because, again, he was comfortable here last year. And I think he's a much better rider since then. So, definitely one to keep an eye on. I think Morbidelli's got a good chance of winning this one as well and doubling up.
Yeah, well, the only thing I would say in preview to Moto 3 before we go is, which will Romano Fenati do? Will he win or kick someone? He usually does one or the other in Argentina. Or both. Yeah, he usually does one or the other. He usually either wins or switches someone's bike off. Because that's pretty much Romano Fenati's Argentine Grand Prix history. So we will see this weekend. We look forward to following it all as the weekend goes on. As I say, all the places you can find us, where you'll probably see us talking a bit of bikes as well as the weekend unfolds, and a bit of Formula One, because that's back this weekend too. On Facebook, facebook.com/motorsport101. On Twitter, motorsport_101 to find us on there. We are on YouTube, youtube.com/motorsport101. And you can find our podcast in all the good places where podcasts are released, including SoundCloud and iTunes. If you want to back us financially and you like us that much, of course you can by heading to Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. And as I mentioned at the start of the show, if you do back us there, you'll know that because you're listening to this before everyone else, because you get early access to both Motorsport 101 and Bike Life. Motorsport 101 episode 79, The Ultimate Thrill Drive, is available right now. So if you haven't listened to it already, go check it out. Because now this show is over. And next week, episode 81, find out if Lewis Hamilton has managed to wangle Dre off the Ferrari narcotic. What do you reckon, Dre?
Probably. Like, I've been here too many times, Sonny. I've been here too many times.
You can really tell listeners he's trying not to build his hopes up.
Nope. Absolutely. I'm really trying not to, because, like... I said it on episode 80. If Ferrari wins here and Vettel wins here, then start believing. If not, then well, it could still be a long season. Like, China is basically a glorified Tilkodrome. It's the Tilkodrome out there. So given that China's probably a lot more representative of what the F1 season is compared to Albert Park, then hey, if Ferrari's good around here, we might be onto something. If not, well. It's going to be a long season till November. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So Sebastian Vettel gets it on this weekend. Look forward to another Conor McGregor style intro from Dre next week. Look forward to that next week. As I say, the tentative plan is for Motorsport 101 next Wednesday, Bike Live more than likely next Friday here on Motorsport 101. So keep an eye out for that. That just about does us for this week. Then huge thanks to Andre Harrison for joining me this week. Huge thank you to all of you for listening this week. This is being Bike Live episode 6 here on Motorsport 101. We look forward to joining you next week for episode 7 and indeed for episode 81 of Motorsport 101. So until then, from the two of us, it's a very warm goodbye.
Sayonara.
This week's episode of Bike Live is dedicated to the memory of Mick Walley, the rider who lost his life tragically at Donington Park at the weekend in the Ducati Performance Tri-Options Cup race. The rider sadly succumbed to his injuries at the Queen's Medical Centre in Nottingham. Our thoughts go to his family and his friends.